From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game.
At the end of the day, Londoners love football. You know, we get more fans here than some NFL franchises. So give us a team in London, then we'll call it a real world championship for a Super Bowl.
Two NFL teams stopped in London for tea and crumpets last Sunday, but will those feet in modern time again walk upon England's pitches green? Ahead on Only a Game, our football comes to Wembley, and a preview of Arma Gridiron 2007, Pats versus Colts. Also ahead, an NBA regular season preview with Kevin Hench, Appalachian State University's football dynasty, and Kid Delicious pockets the moniker Last Great American Pool Hustler. Stay tuned. This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. Good and evil, light and dark, matter and antimatter, all these battles are as nothing compared to what will take place tomorrow when the undefeatable New England Patriots sweep into Indianapolis from the northern lands to take on the undefeated Colts in a struggle that will not only determine the direction of the 2007 NFL season, but quite possibly the fate of the world. Joining me now on the line is Bob Kravitz of the Indianapolis Star. Bob, welcome to Only a Game.
I think you're understating things. I think you're guilty of gross understatement.
Yeah, I kind of thought that that might be your take on this. But is it true that tomorrow's game is going to be the biggest, greatest, most important thing that has ever happened?
Yeah, just a couple of lifetimes. You know, I mean, just looking at it statistically, I mean, I know we're goofing around about it, but, I mean, in the history of the NFL, two unbeaten teams have never met this late in the season. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I mean, there is some historical foundation for saying that it is the biggest game. It won't matter if the Colts go out to San Diego next week and get killed, and I don't know that they can win at San Diego, especially a week after the game of the millennia, but, you know, it's tough coming back from that, right?
Right.
But there are more important games in trying to determine playoffs and all that. But, you know, three times in the last five seasons, these two teams have met in a regular season. The winner of that game has gotten home field advantage, and they've taken home field advantage all the way to a Super Bowl ring. Mm-hmm, so, mm-hmm. You know, there's a reason to accept the idea that this is one hell of a big game.
Has there been any point during this week when, as a resident of Indianapolis, you have had to simply turn off the television, the radio, stop looking at the newspaper because it's all become too much?
No, because as a media member, you kind of got to soak it all in. It doesn't leave room for much of anything else, like, you know, reading a book, speaking to your children, you know, mowing the lawn. I mean, it just takes everything away from you. But, yeah, I mean, there are times you just want to put a bullet in your head, quite honestly, when you listen to some of this nonsense. But, you know, I mean, it is what we do, and I like to think of myself as part of the hype. So, you know, yeah, it's better than being, you know, like a Jets, somebody covering the Jets, where, you know, there's no hype, there's no interest. You just know they're going to get creamed on Sundays. It's not necessarily a bad thing.
The Colts are the defending Super Bowl champions, and they are undefeated. They're playing at home, and yet it's the Patriots, led by their quarterback Tom Brady, a.k.a. Hunky McFabulous, who are favored tomorrow. Does this bother the Colts and their fans? Because last time I checked, they got a pretty good quarterback and a pretty good team,
yeah.
Too.
First of all, Hunky McFabulous, my wife calls me that, so I don't know where you came up with that for Brady.
The lawsuit is on the way. She can't use that phrase.
Yeah, you know, I mean, I think some people get, you know, all bent out of shape about, oh, the Colts are being disrespected. They're underdogs, you know, Super Bowl champions playing at home. But, you know, I mean, the truth is that the people who set those lines, you know, the smart guys in Vegas, they know what they're doing. I mean, they're trying to get an equal number of bets on both sides of the number. And, it, you know, it's not a sign of respect or disrespect. You know, it's not the media saying that, you know, that they deserve to be 5-point underdogs. It's just it's a betting thing, a Vegas thing. And, you know, I think the Colts and most of their fans understand what that means.
The Patriots, of course, were caught illegally taping an opposing team during the first game of the season. They averaged 40 points a game this year. They've been accused of running up the score. One wonders whether they should just embrace that role and take the field wearing black hats and capes and laughing maniacally.
I think they have accepted the role as the NFL's version of the Huns. And I think they're playing with this giant chip on their shoulder. It's like, you know, they're angry at the NFL for having caught them. You know, it's a really strange dynamic. But I think they've internalized it as, well, now people are saying that our Super Bowls were tainted, and we're not going to put up with that. We're going to show everybody we can win without our camcorders. I mean, it's Harry High School stuff. But, you know, you'd be amazed at the nonsense that motivates pro athletes.
The NFL has long been mocked as the no-fun league. Does the Pats-Colts rivalry taking this hyperbolic step loosen things up, or will the league continue to be as serious as ever?
Well, I mean, as long as they don't celebrate in the end zone, I guess it's all right, you know. I don't see in New England scoring a touchdown and having the whole team run out into the end zone to celebrate like Georgia against Florida. I do think, though, that, you know, you're looking at a league that went through the whole Spygate deal, Michael Vick, Pac-Man Jones. This is what the league is supposed to be. This is what you want the hype for. I mean, they need to embrace what's happening here because this is the best moment the NFL has had all season. And, you know, to dismiss it, oh, it's just one game and there are eight more to go after this or whatever. What's, you know, I mean, we love the game because it's Armageddon every week and it's supposed to be over the top. You're supposed to be hysterical, win or lose. I think that's a good thing. When's the last time there was any hype for a National Hockey League game?
A what?
Exactly. My point exactly.
Bob Kravitz is a columnist for the Indianapolis Star. Bob, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Okay, thank you.
Tomorrow's Colts-Patriots extravaganza represents this season's most highly anticipated regular season game in the U.S., that is. Last Sunday, only a game's Karen Given attended the most highly anticipated American football game in British history, and she has this report.
Welcome to the NFL's Big JT Events.
It's lunchtime at Canary Wharf in London's business district, and as gray-suited office workers stream out into an unusually sunny late October afternoon, they're greeted by another unusual sight, a 26-foot-tall animatron of Miami Dolphins defensive end Jason Taylor.
3, 2, 1, wake up, Big JT!
In the week before the Dolphins host the Giants at Wembley Stadium, Big JT is carted from Trafalgar Square to a mall parking lot in Essex. Along the way, he meets NFL fans, tourists, and kids who, despite school vacation week, might be called upon to answer a question or two.
How many points is a touchdown worth? I'll give you a clue. It's more than 5, less than 7. Absolutely right. Nice one.
But it appears that many British people know the score when it comes to the NFL. 5 million people in the UK watched the Super Bowl this year, and the NFL insists it received requests for more than 500,000 tickets for the Giants-Dolphins game. 3.5 hours before game time, Nick and Carrie duck under Wembley Stadium's arching roof to get out of the rain. Carrie's decked out in her best Panthers kit. Nick's proudly supporting the Raiders. Nick expects this to be like any other Dolphins home game, with one difference.
Wetter. Apart from that, yeah, I'm expecting all the noise, all the colour, all the action, you know. I think, you know, this isn't an exhibition, this is for real, you know. So I think they're going to go at it, you know. I think we're going to see a good game.
And hope we get another one soon.
Yeah.
Jill and Richard don't know what to expect. They've been brought to the game by two Vermonters, Mary Ellen and Tom, who gave them a short primer on the game during the train ride to the stadium.
I don't know which way the ball's going or whatever, but I shall join in.
We just know that they wear an awful lot of padding and need to stop too often for drinks and orange juice.
And since you're sitting with a Giants fan, will you be cheering for the Giants?
No, I'm a Dolphins fan. And from what I can gather, the Dolphins need every supporter they can get, because they don't do a lot of scoring, apparently. So we'll be cheering them along.
From the looks of things, Richard will be in good company. While most Americans know about David Beckham, the English know about Dan Marino. Fans queue for entry into the invitation-only tailgate party, complete with stilt walkers, football-themed carnival games, face painters, cheerleaders, and a live band. Glenn Watson and his friends traveled from Miami for today's game and have been surprised at how many fellow Dolphins they've found here.
On the tube ride here, we sang the Dolphin fight song from the time we boarded until the time we arrived here at the stadium.
One, two, three.
Miami has the Dolphins, the greatest football team.
A few yards away, a man decked out in a chainmail hood and carrying a large sword hands out business cards which say,
I'm Keith Smith, the Crusader Raider from London, England.
The NFL has said that if the London game is successful, up to two regular season games could be played next year in Britain, Germany, Mexico, or Canada. And all 32 teams may eventually play one game a year outside the U.S. But for Keith, one regular season game every few years is not nearly enough.
At the end of the day, Londoners love football. When we had the first time the Monarchs were here, we had 66,000 people in Wembley Stadium for regular season games. You know, we get more fans here than some NFL franchises. So give us a team in London, then we'll call it a real world championship for a Super Bowl.
As the game begins, it certainly does seem like Londoners love the NFL. But if American football is so popular here, why wasn't the city's NFL Europe team, the London Monarchs, able to make a go of it? And why did NFL Europe fold altogether? Gordon Sparks, covering the game for Radio London, thinks NFL Europe's biggest problem was the popularity of the NFL itself.
We're virtually at saturation point in this country. Soccer is big here. What you guys call soccer is huge in this country. But this international sport with Formula One motor racing, rugby union is huge in this country. The sport of cricket, that's big, believe it or not. So there is a pecking order. NFL is at the bottom of that pecking order, but NFL Europe was below it, and it was getting no TV coverage whatsoever.
While the broadcasters in the booth behind us take a moment or two to remind listeners of the significance of the fourth down, Sparks rejects the idea that the British need to be educated about football's basic rules. And he says today's attendance is much more than a fluke.
The price of the tickets, you've got to be a real fan to part with that sort of silly money to come and see American football at Wembley. If New York score on this play, you hear the cheer that goes up. Going to be Eli Manning running for the end zone. He's going to get in. He did. He got in.
The Dolphins won't answer that touchdown until after the two-minute warning, leaving the Giants to run out the clock to the sound of boos from the British fans. But just like the Miami Dolphins who don't stop singing, even when it becomes clear their losing streak will extend to eight, fans of the NFL in London stream out of Wembley Stadium into the rainy night, laughing and cheering and hoping that the other football will be back again soon.
Miami Dolphins number one!
For Only a Game, I'm Karen Gibbon in London.
Miami Dolphins number one!
It's 19 minutes past the hour. A giraffe was born at the Franklin Park Zoo in Boston last week, but the staff at the zoo didn't name the 6-foot-2-inch infant until Monday, a day after the Red Sox had won the World Series. The zookeepers knew they wanted to name the new arrival Sox, but they didn't want to jinx the ball club by doing so before the Red Sox had won. Would zookeepers anywhere else in the world have worried about the impact naming a giraffe might have on the fortunes of the local baseball team? Anyway, zoo president John Linehan said the staff chose the name because of the giraffe calf's long, lanky legs. A giraffe with long legs. Remarkable. I'm Bill Littlefield, ahead on Only a Game. Appalachian State reaches for the old mountain jug. But first, the NBA regular season began this week, and here to preview the rest of the 2007-2008 campaign of the Tall Guys in Shorts is Kevin Hench, who covers the league, among other things, for FoxSports.com. Kevin, welcome back to Only a Game.
Good to be here, Bill.
The world champion San Antonio Spurs began their title defense on Tuesday night by defeating the Portland Trail Blazers and by extending Tim Duncan's contract through 2011-2012. Then they beat Memphis on Wednesday. Not a bad start, right?
Well, a typically good start for the Spurs, and you could hear the collective yawn from all NBA fans across the nation as we contemplate another meticulous, grinding Spurs drive to the title. Not the most exciting team, but certainly the most effective.
In Los Angeles, the Kobe watch has been ongoing for about 6 months. Are we about to see the downfall of a formerly great NBA team?
We're seeing it. It is the House of Usher is coming apart at the seams, and it's awesome. If you hate the Lakers like I do, you know, as a Celtic fan, I've been hating the Lakers for a long time, and to see the Lakers on the verge of getting maybe not even 40 cents on the dollar for Kobe Bryant is just awesome. He's a delightful guy, as you know, and, you know, the whole saga out here of Phil Jackson and his girlfriend Jeannie Buss and Kobe getting booed on opening night, it's just been awesome for Laker haters. Best time ever.
Let's assume that Kobe Bryant does eventually get traded and traded to Chicago, which is certainly one of the trades that's been anticipated. How does he fit in there?
Well, I'm not sure. I don't know if Kobe's goal is to fit in. It would depend a lot upon what they leave in the cupboard in Chicago, and I really don't see how the Bulls could acquire Kobe without including Lou Aldang, even though now Kobe has said, I don't want to go to Chicago if you leave the cupboard bare. It's kind of a catch-22. It's like, Kobe, either you're worth this much or you're not, and we can't trade you to Chicago straight up for Tyrus Thomas. So we're going to need something in return, which is all part of the conundrum, which makes it so wonderful. One nice thing about Kobe going to Chicago following Kevin Garnett from the Western Conference to the Eastern Conference would be to get some superstars back in the Eastern Conference to level out that disparity a little bit. But yeah, you're not going to get value. You're not going to get market value for Kobe Bryant, not when the fans are booing him and the coach is fed up.
Golden State's Steven Jackson was arrested for firing a gun in public last year. He was also a key instigator in the infamous brawl in Detroit 3 years ago, so it's only fitting that the Warriors recently made him a co-captain, right?
Well, my favorite part of the Steven Jackson story is the new tattoo he brought to camp this year. It's clasped hands praying in front of a church, which sounds good, except that the hands have a gun in them.
I shouldn't be laughing at this, I know, but
So that's the kind of leadership you need in a team captain.
Absolutely.
That's good times in Golden State.
The power of the church and the power of the gun. How do they lose a game?
Well, they certainly psyched out the Mavs last year. The Mavs were not ready for that level of helter-skelter physicality.
Well, let's talk generally about how things are going to play out in the Western Conference. Where do we find surprises this year?
Well, I don't know if you can call it a surprise, but I really think Phoenix gets over the hump this year. They're my pick to win it all. Yes, they still don't play much defense, but I think Grant Hill was a great addition. I think Brian Skinner is a more physical, more active, younger Kurt Thomas. And I like them to finally, you know, but for a couple of calls in Game 3, in the game Tim Donaghy did, the Suns could be trying to defend their title instead of trying to win their first one. And I just love that team. I love watching that team. They're just the best product in the NBA.
The Eastern Conference, once a laughingstock, now boasts some improved, if not perhaps quite championship-caliber teams. But somebody has to contend. Which of those teams do you think it will be?
Well, you know, I don't like to pick with my heart because then I'm not only crushed at the end of the season, I'm wrong. But for the first time ever in radio, TV, my column, I picked the Red Sox to win the World Series back in April. This year, my head and my heart have been converging a little bit with the Red Sox, and I got to say, I'm not picking them to win the title, but I am picking the Celtics to lose to the Suns in the finals. So I think KG and Ray Allen and Paul Pierce will get the Celtics back to the promised land where they'll lose, but they'll get to the finals. A lot of people like the Pistons, and I just feel like that team has aged a little bit, and they're not that deep. They lost Rodney Stuckey to injury, and I just don't think the same gang of five can strap it on for another 82 games and get all the way there.
In a Tuesday interview, NBA Commissioner David Stern criticized the New York Knicks, saying the team's embarrassing offseason, quote, demonstrates that they're not a model of intelligent management. That's the harshest criticism he's offered regarding the sexual harassment lawsuit against the team and Isaiah Thomas's insensitive remarks during testimony, but is it enough?
It's so not enough. Yeah, withering criticism from the commish, who will ruin his own playoff season by suspending players for walking 4 feet off the bench, but has an embarrassment running the team in the biggest market in the country, and all he can come up with is a little withering criticism. Look, I mean, I don't know if Stern is thinking about his legacy or not caring about his legacy, but the fact is, the league's in trouble. The finals were the lowest rated ever last year. The Tim Donaghy ref betting scandal is apocalyptically bad and dangerous. But, yeah, I've been shocked at David Stern. It's like he made his pension and he doesn't care anymore. He's just trying not to get shot in the line of duty or something. I don't know what he's doing. He's doing nothing.
Stern responded to the Tim Donaghy scandal, the gambling scandal, by changing the rules for referees and saying basically it's okay now for them to gamble at the horse track and in the casinos, places like that. I'm just wondering if that, too, was a completely misguided move.
Of course. I mean, yes, most people can go to a casino and play blackjack or buy a lottery ticket or whatever and not have a problem. But he only needs one of his 56 referees to have a problem to ruin the league. So, you know, I mean, this is such a slippery slope. You get one ref in a casino who gets down, you know, a couple hundred grand playing blackjack, and the next thing you know, he's making sure every game he does goes over. It's inexplicable. It is such a terrible move. That is the one area he needs to have zero tolerance in. And so what he does, instead of having zero tolerance with the refs and gambling, he has it with wearing blue jeans on the bench. That's where his focus is.
Kevin Hench covers basketball, baseball, football, soccer, badminton, hockey, and wife carrying for FoxSports.com. Thank you, Kevin.
Thank you, Bill.
The Mets' World Series win over the Orioles in 1969 certainly qualifies as a major upset, as does the triumph of the U.S. men's Olympic hockey team over the Russians in 1980. To that list, you can add Appalachian State University football's defeat of then-fifth-ranked Michigan in September. But ASU's stunning victory is only one chapter in their success story, only a game's Ron Schachter reports from Boone, North Carolina.
The hometown of Appalachian State University, set in North Carolina's Smoky Mountains, is named for Daniel Boone. But lately, the ASU football team has been doing some pioneering of its own and has gone where no team like it has gone before.
Into open field now. Dexter Jackson's sprinting free. He's going to take this one all the way for the touchdown.
When the Mountaineers defeated mighty Michigan before almost 110,000 Wolverine fans in the first game of the season, they pulled off one of the biggest upsets in college football history.
The Mountaineers of Appalachian State have just beaten the Michigan Wolverines in the Big House.
Now that the shoutings died down, the Mountaineers are aiming for their third straight championship in the NCAA's renamed Football Championship Subdivision, formerly known as 1AA. In Boone's compact downtown, ASU's black and gold colors hang from the lampposts, and the T-shirt and souvenir business at stores like Mountaineer Mania is booming. Wanda Courier sits at the shop sewing machine, attaching Greek letters to a sorority sweatshirt. But her hottest items are the ones touting the 34-32 final score of the Michigan game. Many with the punchline, numbers don't lie.
We've had a successful business for 26 years, but this has been phenomenal. Nothing like it before. They are buying everything. We're still selling, even this far after the Michigan game, selling a lot of Michigan game day type shirts. But we're selling everything else that says Appalachian also.
Appalachian State's own online store has seen a $100,000 increase in business since the September upset of Michigan. But athletic director Charlie Cobb places greater weight on a different number.
One of the things that we like to tell people is the fact that up until the Michigan game, we had about 10,000 visitors a day to our website. And then since the Michigan win, or Labor Day weekend, we've averaged 45,000 visitors to our website. And certainly they're interested in our athletic program, but they're also interested in our university.
A little different slant on this stuff today now. A little different slant. A lot of movement. Give me some movement.
Still, compared to Division I-A football programs, now known as the Football Bowl Subdivision, ASU is small scale. Instead of 85 football scholarships, championship division schools are limited to 63. The stadium here seats under 17,000, less than some high school venues in Texas. Mountaineers coach Jerry Moore, who once worked as an assistant at Nebraska and head coach at Texas Tech, has made adjustments to keep his team competitive, even with big-time programs like Michigan, Auburn, and Wake Forest, whom Appalachian State has defeated five times during Moore's tenure.
Let's go right here. Hurry up, slow.
ASU runs a no-huddle offense all the time to keep the opposition off balance. Moore insists on extra conditioning from his players. Since he arrived in 1989, he's made ASU's football scholarships go farther by splitting them, often allowing him to get two players for the price of one. And he's made the most of non-scholarship or walk-on players.
We're able to put a lot of walk-on kids on at least a half scholarship, a few of them on a full. We'll word spread. Hey, you can go to Appalachian, walk on to Appalachian. If you don't get a scholarship someplace, they're taking care of the walk-on kids. And after 10 years, we'd put over 100 kids on scholarship that walked on here. So it's close to 200 probably now. And that's been our lifeline.
Senior running back Kevin Richardson arrived as one of those walk-ons in 2004.
I was maybe like sixth-string running back, and I didn't get as many looks as the other guys. But whenever I got a look, I would take advantage of it. I would have a good play that the coaches would like, you know what I'm saying? And then that would give me more opportunities to make plays.
Richardson earned a partial scholarship after that first year, became an All-American, broke ASU's career rushing and scoring records, and is contending for this year's Walter Payton Award, the championship division's version of the Heisman Trophy.
You guys be hard on each other. Then when Saturday gets here, you've seen it 1,000 times.
Even when it came to playing Michigan, Moore bucked the conventional wisdom that teams like his were early season fodder for the big boys.
Everybody used to, and we even us, used to think of them as money games. You're going to go play Auburn, you're going to get $400,000. You're going to play LSU, you're going to get $400,000. But a few years ago, I got to thinking, hey, these are really opportunity games. They're opportunities for us to show our stuff, for us to really get better, to play good competition. And never once did I ever refer to Michigan as a money game.
For all the recent national attention, football at ASU is still a largely local affair. 90% of the players come from this part of the state. Next Saturday, ASU will renew its annual battle for the Old Mountain Jug with neighboring Western Carolina. And senior quarterback Trey Elder, who shares the position with sophomore Armonte Edwards, says that ASU's recent accomplishments in the postseason are at least as important as upsetting traditional powerhouses.
I mean, beating Michigan is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity, but so is winning a national championship, and we did it twice, back-to-back. Not many people in the country can say that they've won two national titles. And it's just something that we put a lot of work into, and knowing what it took to get there is just something you'll never forget.
To pursue their third straight title, the 6-2 and 9th-ranked Mountaineers will likely have to reach the postseason tournament, which begins in 3 weeks, as an at-large team. They currently trail in the Championship Division Southern Conference and will try to move up in the standings in today's contest at Citadel. For Only a Game, I'm Ron Schachter in Boone, North Carolina.
Good. Here we go. Switch out the bar. Start with 3 down here. Here we go.
You're listening to Only a Game. Today in Major League Soccer postseason action, New York is at New England, where the weather is expected to be partly cloudy and in the mid-50s. The Saturday forecast for Los Angeles, where Chivas USA will host Kansas City, calls for sunny skies and temperatures in the mid-80s. As commentator Alyssa Eli points out, those conditions make attending matches enjoyable for players, spectators, and dogs.
Rain started to fall during the first minutes of the soccer game. Soon it was pouring. For the 10-year-old players, this was an added and exhilarating benefit at first. But when the novelty of deliberately missing balls and sliding into mud wore off, complaints began. It was getting chilly. Uniforms were hanging. Fun in the rain was yesterday's news. We had thought to bring umbrellas and huddled under them on the beach chairs we had also thought to bring. But there was no room for the dog we had brought without thinking. She lay just outside the umbrella, motionless like Rushmore. Her breed detests getting wet, and her dripping, dignified, uncomplaining nose reminded us of this. The dog's been coming to soccer games since our athlete began playing in kindergarten. She's an old and lovely dog, beloved to children on sight. Over many years, she's become an involuntary mascot, endlessly tolerant of team affections, though I suspect she does not feel the same affection in return. There's a look she gives me when a crowd of soccer players are combing her hair in the wrong direction or wrenching her paw instead of shaking it. It's an expression of unshakable faith. If you brought me here, the look says, there's a reason. I don't question these kids pulling my paw. Give me a word, just one word, and I'll offer them the other one to pull, too. During halftime, members of the team wandered over to visit her. There were oranges in their mouths instead of teeth. Look at that, one of them said. She's soaked. She really hates water, her owner said authoritatively. Well, she's an old dog, someone else said. The explanation satisfied them. Then the second half began, 30 minutes more of mud and dank. The girls ran back and forth in the rain, enjoying themselves no longer, complaining more bitterly with each pass. The dog lay perfectly still. They ran by her the whole time, and they never once saw perfect love where it lay right in front of them.
So it must be raindrops, so many raindrops. It feels like raindrops.
Alyssa Eli is a psychiatrist living in Boston.
Falling from my eyes.
It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. The construction site offering girls and boys of all ages blocks and building toys, both domestic and imported, at constructiontoys.com. And Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Information is available at Bicon.com, Bicon.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
I'm Scott Simon.
No, you're not.
Why listen to the newsy prattle from Weekend Edition Saturday when you can tune in to Only a Game for one whole hour of really boffo sports stuff?
Hey, Bill, come on, that's not really fair.
My name is Scott.
Hey, get me rewrite.
Take it from me, Scott Simon. Don't listen to Weekend Edition Saturday from NPR News. Lasha Pataria has six A's in his name, which is remarkable. Even more remarkable are his very strong ears. In order to demonstrate the strength of one of those ears, he recently attached a rope to it. Then he attached the other end of the rope to the front wheel of a military helicopter sitting on an airfield near Tbilisi, the capital of the nation of Georgia. The helicopter weighs a little over 17,000 pounds. As a small crowd cheered, Mr. Pataria pulled the helicopter about 20 yards, which, as far as anyone could determine, set a new world record for pulling a helicopter with your ear. Mr. Pataria reported that he was very nervous. It was very difficult, he said.
When she's up there twirling round, just like a helicopter, copter, she's landing on the top.
I'm Bill Littlefield, coming up on Only a Game, New Jersey Fats. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for a discussion of the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Bill.
Former New York Yankees manager Joe Torre is now the Dodgers skipper. How does he fare in Los Angeles?
I don't know pretty well, but why, if you're Joe Torre, do you do it? I mean, you're in the Hall of Fame. You've managed to turn your entire image within the history of the sport around in 12 years with the Yankees. Everybody is on your side. Now you're going to go out and manage a marginal playoff team for a lot of money, halfway all the way across the country at your age. I mean, to me, this cried out for Joe Torre to retire to the tarpon boat and wait for the call from Cooperstown.
Well, of course, the question is, does this alleged marginal playoff team become the Yankees West?
Well, it looks that Jorge Posada will certainly follow him out there. It's possible that Mariano Rivera will. Don Mattingly has left the Yankees. The Yankees, with Alex Rodriguez opting out of his deal, are now in complete disarray. Nobody's arguing with the fact that it was a good time for Joe Torre to get away from the Yankees. It's just I'm arguing that it's not a particularly good time for him to go to the Dodgers.
How do you like Joe Girardi's chances of being a successful manager following Joe Torre?
Well, I mean, he walked in, you know, with his eyes open. He knows what he's being handed. He's being handed a bag of rags by a crazy person and told to make couture out of it. I get the feeling that Hank Steinbrenner, we're having the same problem with the Steinbrenner family that we had with the Windsors in England, that the further down the generations you go, the less sharp the knives in the drawer are. Hank Steinbrenner is not off to a great start here.
Charlie, 3 years ago, the Red Sox got into a fight about the ball that was in play during the last out of the World Series. And
naturally,
this time
we wouldn't do it again, right?
No, this time around, they've apparently lost the season's ultimate baseball. Do you think they need more practice winning the World Series and dealing with the consequences?
You know, they did everything right. You can see Jason Varitek take the ball and put it in his back pocket after the last strikeout in the fourth game.
Mm-hmm.
He claims he gave it to Jonathan Papelbon. Now, having watched Jonathan Papelbon post-game performances on the field, on the duck boats, on the David Letterman show, that ball could be anywhere right now.
Barry Bonds said this week that he will not be part of his Hall of Fame induction ceremony if the hall displays the asterisked home run number 756 ball. Is that the sound of loud yawning I hear emanating from the general direction of Cooperstown?
Well, it may be loud yawning coming from Cooperstown, but it's a standing ovation from the Office of the Commissioner of Baseball, who certainly don't want whoever else goes in the hall with Barry Bonds to be part of that circus. If he says he isn't going to show up, then the Barry Bonds factor is gone. Everybody, this is a win-win all the way around.
As far as pro football is concerned, Colts...
You could care less.
Colts, Pats, need I say more? Even I care this week.
You know what? I think New England's going to win this game by 4 touchdowns. I really do. As good as the Colts are, they're not as good as the Patriots. After that, I mean, I think it's a very significant, it's probably the single most significant regular season game that I can recall, because the winner of this game will host, in all likelihood, the American Football Conference Championship game, which means this game will determine when these teams next play in January, whether they play indoors in Indianapolis or outdoors in Foxborough.
There has been some speculation that Coach Bill Belichick and the Pats have been running up scores. Charlie, staying with your starting quarterback when you have a 45-0 lead will cause that kind of talk from time to time. Is running up the score the right characterization of what the Patriots have been doing?
Absolutely. Bill Belichick has found a foolproof way to flip off the entire NFL establishment, with which he is still upset because of the spy Cameragate deal in the first week of the season. Nobody can fine him for his team being too good. And yet he's rubbing it in everybody's faces and then denying he's doing it. This comes under the heading of one of those things that you shouldn't do while telling me it's raining. Of course he's running up the score. Of course he's trying to make a statement. And most people who will argue the opposite will spend about 3 minutes arguing that he's not running up the score and then spend the next 15 minutes arguing that it's a really good idea that he's running up the score.
This fellow Lloyd Lake, who is suing former Southern California running back Reggie Bush for almost $300,000, is this sort of like the guy who calls the police to complain that somebody has stolen his bag of cocaine?
Yeah. That's exactly what it is. Give me back my bribes, you miscreant. Deliver up to me all the money I used to pay you off. It seems like there's a cause of action here. It's going to do tremendous damage to the reputation of the USC teams that Reggie Bush played on. I don't know if it matters much to anybody else beyond that, but this is very much like suing to get back the profits of the illegal drug deal that somebody foiled.
Okay. Quote quiz. What 5-time Grand Slam champion from Switzerland said this week, "I have tested positive, but I have never taken drugs, and I feel 100% innocent."
Well, that's very good, because it's important to feel innocent, because that's what the law takes into account, of course. It would be Martina Hingis, who also said she found the accusation so horrendous, so monstrous, that she's decided to confront it head-on by talking to the press. Okay, we're on your side, Martina, but guess what? We can't change the drug test. You flunked the drug test, or so someone says.
And finally, in honor of Halloween, Detroit Lions quarterback John Kitna and his wife dressed up as a naked man and the attendant at a fast food drive-through window. Pretty funny, huh?
Yeah, he got embarrassed because he's getting some heat on the TV in a newspaper column. John Kitna is a born-again Christian. An awful lot of those people are public scolds, and now he's on the receiving end of it. Because people in Detroit are upset that he was dressed up as a naked man is an interesting concept, by the way.
Absolutely.
Does that mean he was a naked man, or does it mean he was dressed up as a naked man?
Well, he probably had one.
Was he wearing, like, a naked man suit?
Yeah.
Is that what they meant by the costume flap in the headline?
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine. He joins me each week at this time on Only a Game. Thanks, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill. That's your voodoo work. That's your voodoo work. Voodoo working and I can't get a loop. There are few lines of work in which improving your performance leads directly to a decrease in your opportunities and your income. Hustling pool is one such endeavor. Get good enough at it, everybody sees you coming, and nobody wants to play you. Such was one of the problems faced by Danny Bacevich, a.k.a. Kid Delicious, the subject of a new book by L. John Wertheim titled Running the Table, The Legend of Kid Delicious, The Last Great American Pool Hustler. L. John Wertheim joins me now from NPR's New York Bureau. Mr. Wertheim, welcome back to Only a Game.
Thanks. Good to be here.
And alongside Mr. Wertheim in New York is Kid Delicious himself, Danny Bacevich. Should I call you Kid?
Yeah, that sounds great. It's great. It's great to be here.
Okay. Just so our listeners won't be distracted by the matter, why don't you tell us, Danny, how you acquired the nickname Kid Delicious?
In my beginning years of trying to get as good as I can at pool, there was a famous pool room in Manhattan in the Village on 21st and 6th called Chelsea Billiards. And I played this guy named Kid Vicious. He was the top pool player in the city at the time. And I drove into New Jersey with a few of my friends. And long story short, I ended up beating him out of $4,200 in a big-time money match where everyone in this city thought I was going to lose. And when the match was over, they said, Kid Vicious just got his money taken by Kid Delicious.
And no pool player really is at the top of his game until he earns a nickname, I guess.
It seems that way. It seems like you're right. It's kind of funny, but most of the top players in the world all do have a nickname. And I got that nickname when I really wasn't maybe considered like maybe one of the best in the world. I might have been considered a very good player, but I've really earned that nickname just luckily, and everything seems to come together with that Kid Delicious.
Well, when did you first realize and how did you first realize that you had an exceptional aptitude for playing pool?
Well, pretty much when I first started to play. I mean, the first day I walked in a pool room when I was about 13 years old, named Elite Billiards, about a bicycle ride away from my home. And I walked in, and immediately I found a great love of the game. And it made me so happy, too. And it was just amazing how much it brightened up my life and how soon I knew I had something special in my hands right away.
John, how did you first learn about Kid Delicious?
Well, the story is I was reading the Wall Street Journal about 3 years ago, and they had a recap of a pool event at Grand Central Station. And just sort of in passing, they had mentioned one of the players in the field. I forget how they phrased it, but it was, you know, a heavy-set hustler from New Jersey named Kid Delicious who made a six-figure income hustling. And then they sort of went on with what happened with the rest of the tournament. And I said, you know, I don't particularly care who won this tournament. I want to know more about the Kid Delicious who made six figures hustling.
Danny, at one point you went on the hustling road with a road buddy who goes by the name of Bristol. He calls you the master of the soft hustle. Give us an example of how a soft hustle works.
I guess the main thing would be, I guess, to be able to gamble with a guy and get him to lose his money and enjoy it while you're doing that. Mm. And I tell you, most of the time, it might have not even been just hustling at all. It pretty much would just be me being myself. I mean, I would play guys for whatever the money was, whether it was for $10 or for $10,000. And, you know, whether I won or lost the game, I would be laughing the whole time and smiling and telling jokes. And whoever was watching, I'd be, you know, whether I was losing, I'd be talking to people on the side and, you know, and they'd be telling me stuff. And if the other guy played real well or if there was any kind of a big argument or discussion, I always just let it go real smooth and, you know, never get no arguments. And by the end of the night, I knew for sure I was going to end up with their money.
John, do you have a candidate for Danny's greatest day or night of pool hustling?
Well, I think he'd tell you it was when he took $25,000, $30,000 from the Philadelphia mob. But I like some of the initial stories where he was just trying to get the choreography of the hustle, and one of them was he would go to local campuses in New Jersey and sort of pose as the clumsy, overweight freshman, and he would go and buy a school sweatshirt and splatter some beer, some chocolate cake on his sweatshirt, go down to the pool hall and, you know, buy a Coke with a $100 bill and sort of fumble around at the table, and the guys would get on their cell phones and call their buddies to tell them about the clumsy freshman with, you know, bleeding money who was going to lose it all. And then when the stakes got sufficiently high, he would run the table and hustle these slick college kids.
Well, these are cute stories, Danny, but I think we better hear about the 25,000 to 30,000 that you took from the mob.
Well, it was one of me and Bristol Bob's beginning of our trips. We were just an hour from my home in Manalapan, New Jersey, and Bristol Bob said, hey, let's stop at the Boulevard Billiards over here in Philadelphia off the boulevard. And we walked in that pool room, and sure enough, there was a few dozen railbirds hanging around, a bunch of guys getting in the middle of action, and there happened to be this one big bookie there who was probably like a superstar mafia guy, as you could say. And he was there, and he wanted to bet some of his money on a couple players, and he had himself a whole team of players. And I ended up, throughout the whole night, I played one guy named Dale, say, for several hours, and beat him out of a couple of thousand. And then another 3 or 4 hours later, I played this other guy, Eddie Abraham, who at the time was the best pool player in Philadelphia. And finally, I'm all sweaty and tired, and I think my night is done. And I'm thinking, he's got nobody left for me. I'm winning all his dough. I'm up almost 15 grand, and I'm going to leave. And all of a sudden, the mafia guy says, you got to play one more. And the last guy is a U.S. Open champion, Spanish Mike LeBron, one of the best players who's ever lived, you know, as good as a player as Willie Mosconi. Mm. And there's a certain code in pool, and when you up money on a guy, you can't just leave with his money. If he has another bet to make, you have to give him the opportunity to win his money back. And I would never do anything against the code because I was always an honorable gambler and guy. So we ended up playing that last match with pretty much about all the money I was up. And I killed myself all night long to finally have to play the great Mike LeBron for about 15 grand. And I ended up beating him in a long, drawn-out match where I was losing 5-0. I went in the bathroom. I was practically crying, and I washed my face off, and I looked in the mirror, and something just got me mad and found some strength from within my heart. And I come out that bathroom, and I run 13 games in a row, beating them 13-5 and winning about 30 grand and getting on out of there.
It sounds like you had a Minnesota Fats moment from the Hustler. He goes into the bathroom, he comes back, his tie is straight, his shirt is clean, and Paul Newman is finished.
Sure. That's exactly what it was like.
All right, I got to ask you about the flip side, though, because every hustler has nights that he would just as soon forget, as well as the glorious night where he wins $30,000. Is there a particular misadventure or disappointment that taught you, maybe this isn't something I can do all my life?
I've never been beat playing for any kind of money over, say, like $100, but there's been a few other things I've lost a lot of money at in my life, and there have been times where I've won $5,000 or $10,000 and that next morning, I end up at the strip club or at the casino, and all of a sudden, my pockets are empty, and I don't know what happened to all my money.
John, how much opportunity is there now for a great pool player like Kid Delicious to make a living in any way other than hustling?
Hustling, unfortunately, seems to be a real dying art for a variety of reasons, but you know, there are these message boards now. It used to be you'd win money in Washington State and you'd be in Denver by the time anyone heard about it. Now, by the time the sun comes up, everybody's read it on a message board. And professional pools had a very hard time forming a viable league. I mean, I think Danny would like to, now that his hustling days seem to be past him, I mean, I think he'd like to be a professional pool player, but there just isn't, poker's obviously gotten big and, virtually every other sport has a league where the top practitioners can go and make a living out of it, and pool just hasn't gotten its act together like that. You know, this is not a golden era for pool players.
You can't really make a living as a hustler anymore. You're too well known, and the hustling opportunities aren't there. And John has said professional pool is not too much of an opportunity. What happens next? I know your parents say at the end of the book, maybe it's time for Danny to get a real job.
Well, my dad sometimes says that because I've made some decent money playing in professional tournaments. I guess decent money for a guy like myself, but like now that I got a girlfriend and she's got a 6-year-old little boy and I'm hoping to have a family of my own, right now I give a lot of lessons actually, which I've been doing really well with them at Empire Billiards in New Jersey and also all over the country. If anyone's interested, they could give me a call. And also I do a lot of exhibitions and bar mitzvahs and stuff like that besides tournaments.
Danny Vasevich, a.k.a. Kid Delicious, joined me from NPR's New York studios. Danny, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thank you very much.
I've also been speaking with L. John Wertheim, the author of Running the Table, The Legend of Kid Delicious, the last great American pool hustler. John, it was good to have you on the show.
Thanks, Bill.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is John Perotti. We had help this week from Julian Saporiti, Vince Fairchild, and Jim Kiesling. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. If you'd like to view Karen Given's Wembley Stadium football photo gallery or listen to stories past and present, please visit onlyagame.org. To order a copy of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287. CDs are $15. That's 1-800-909-9287. Our final word comes from Irish football enthusiast and neophyte Finns fan David Mooney.
I've gone out, I've painted my face, dyed me mohawk, Dolphins colours. I've got a Finns tattoo.
Wow, that is dedication. And nobody in Miami is even doing that these days. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston. The Kellogg Foundation, helping people help themselves by investing in children, their families, and their communities. On the web at WKKF.org. Ann and John Herman, celebrating the Breakthrough Collaborative involving middle school students in learning and older students in teaching at BreakthroughCollaborative.org. And the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, helping to build a more just future for the nation and the world at MacFound.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.